Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our minds, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I'll bring you the latest research about using cell phone to take a break during mentally challenging tasks. Does not allow the brain to recharge effectively and may result in more of a poor performance. Never know. Then I will have my guest. I will speak to Maryam Zahr. She's the chair of the Westside Regional Alliance of Councils, the commissioner for LA Commission on the Status of Women. And she's a founder of Women Found, a nonprofit organization. I'll tell you more about it. And she's the writer for Huffington Post. She also started her own radio and podcast show called Uncommon Conversations. And we'll be talking with her about many of her activist role today, especially about homelessness. You can call us to talk to us, both Maryam Zahr and I, on the studio line, 951-922-3532. Be sure to listen to my podcast in iTunes, Stitcher, and share it with your friends. Go listen to it. Please put a review and put your questions there, or just write me about questions that you have about your relationships, things that you need to know about yourself, or how to just get rid of all the clutter that is in your mind and in your emotions. And I love to hear from you. Go to my website, fujian.com, and email me or text me. I'd love to talk to you. We'll be right back with the tip of the week.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian, Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
So this is the tip of the week. I've been noticing when one is committed to a context of love and affinity, no matter what happens, no matter how everyone else acts, the one who is holding the commitment toward love and peace will keep their peace internally and will impact the outcome of the interaction. I've worked with couples whom one person has been committed to holding the love, listening from the heart, talking from an open and caring place to a mate who's been raging. The result was an amazing dialogue with more understanding and depth. I've witnessed political debates when all that mattered was one person listening with their heart to another person being righteous, and the outcome was still an unbelievable connection. It appears that when you commit yourself to an unwavering space of love and affinity, the world could be filled with its own agenda, and you will still prevail inside with the space of peace of mind and a heart filled with your love. You know, it's good for you. Don't worry about the world. It's good for you. When you hold that type of a vibration, you hold that type of a feeling and a state of being. No matter how many people are raging out there, you will still hold the ground, at least minimum, for yourself and hopefully for people around you. So, love like there's no tomorrow. We'll be right back with the latest research.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
This is the latest research. Using a cell phone to take a break during mentally challenging tasks does not allow the brain to recharge effectively and may result in poor performance. This was a research that was done in Rutgers Business School. The experiment published in the Journal of Behavioral Addiction assigned college undergraduates to solve challenging sets of word puzzles. Halfway through, some were allowed to take breaks using their cell phones. Others took breaks using paper or computer, while some took no breaks at all. So the 414 participants were given sets of 20 word puzzles. Some were given a break halfway through, during which they were told to choose three items to buy within a specific budget using either their cell phone, a paper circular, or a computer. They were told to type or write the reasons for their selection. So then the participants who took phone breaks experienced the highest levels of mental depletion and were among the least capable of solving the puzzles afterward. So their post-break efficiency and quickness was comparable to those with no break. So the ones who actually used their cell phone to buy something in the middle, they were as compatible in the quickness as the ones that actually didn't get any breaks. Their number of word problems solved after the break was slightly better than those who took no break, but worse than all other participants. So participants who took a break on their cell phone took 19% longer to do the rest of the task and solved 22% fewer problems than did the ones in other break conditions combined. So the act of reaching for your phone between tasks or mid-task is becoming more commonplace. It's important to know the costs associated with reaching for this device. During every spare minute, we assume it's no different from taking other breaks, but the phone may carry increasing the levels of distraction that make it difficult to return to and focus your attention to any type of task, especially word tasks. So cell phones may have this effect because even just seeing your phone activates thoughts of checking messages, connecting with people, access to ever refilling information, and more in ways that are different when you just sit behind a screen of a computer or laptops. That's what the research actually showed. It's interesting because when I do that a lot, I actually do take breaks with cell phones. So this is interesting. I'm going to try just to close my eyes at the break and actually listen to a calm music and be able to rejuvenate. And it's accurate. When you go on your phone, it has the accessibility to many different things, whether they're your messages that are coming in, or it's all of your social media that are probably right there giving you feedback, and then your email, and then probably somebody makes a phone call or you have to listen to your messages. So the activities that are right there accessible to you are so much that it just will get you really engrossed in all of them, and it will probably more so create shoot up adrenaline for you and wanting to get you engrossed in any of them versus to not pay attention to anything or pay attention to something that is soft so that you can replenish and refocus back. So some people actually use games in that environment, even with their phone. And even the games are producing the adrenaline and are not necessarily calming them down so they can refocus. Many people who I've worked with have, who have had ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, sometimes they go from one task to another, and they'll go from like two tasks or three tasks in order to all, you know, alternate. But even for them, using the cell phone would be more stimulating and bring a lot of stimulus to them suddenly versus just going from one task to another, even if they're switching the screens of the computer and doing something, or they pay attention to a task that they're doing, like reading, and then they get up and do something that's physical and then come back and do reading again. It seems like shifting from one task to another, if one is physical, one is mental, would probably be better for someone to focus more. If they're trying to focus and while they're doing that, they get tired and they just lose focus. So see if you can let go of that cell phone when you're taking a break and do something else, which is not as stimulating. We'll be right back with my guest, Maryam Zahr, who has a law degree from Pepperdine University. Let me tell you about her. She's a great friend. I'm really proud of her, and I've watched her grow, and I've watched her, let's say, career grow. She's definitely an activist, and she has always been. She's the founder of Women Found, an organization dedicated to raising awareness for the plight of women around the world and advocating for the empowerment of women in patriarchal societies where opportunities and rights for women are scarce. Currently, she chairs the Westside Regional Alliance of Councils, an alliance of 14 neighborhood and community councils spanning the entire west side of Los Angeles, and has been appointed into the boards of Pacific Palisades Park Advisory Board, the Pacific Palisades YMCA, and the Pacific Palisades Design Review Board, as well as a nonprofit helping. She educates children around the world and working in local student homelessness called the More Balanced World. She's the former chair of the Pacific Palisades Community Council and the founding chair of the Pacific Palisades Task Force on Homelessness. She's also an elected delegate for Assembly District 50 and has served on the executive board of the Business and Professional Caucus. She's the former president of PTSA at Paul Revere Middle School in Los Angeles. She has also been recognized for her work by LA County Supervisor for Volunteer of the Year and named Honorary Fire Chief, for Pacific Palisades by Fire Station 69. She was the first VP of Communications for the UN, United Nations Women Chapter of the U.S. National Committee for UN Women in L.A. when it was first founded in 2012, and was recently elected as the delegate for the 50th Assembly District. She's a tireless advocate for everything that is just and an endless creative thinker with the organized skill to motivate people and seek solutions to some of the tough issues that face our community today. She's contributing writer for the Huffington Post, as well as her local Los Angeles newspapers. She is the host of Uncommon Conversation, radio and a podcast show. I'm excited to have her on my show, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Maryam Zahr.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it. Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Welcome to Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I am so excited to have a great friend and a great advocate for women, homeless, and everyone who needs an advocate, Mariam Zahr. It was great to have you on.
It's such a pleasure to be back on your show with you, Fujian. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Mariam, I really need to ask you. I keep hearing that the economy was getting better and better. I mean, now we're hearing about maybe we're going into recession, but for almost a year or and a half, the economy is getting better, better, better. When I go on the streets, Mariam John, that's not what I sense. Actually, this past weekend, I went to downtown, and almost every single street in downtown Los Angeles has become a homeless camp. And then in Orange County, where I moved, similar concept. And I know that in San Clemente, they are offering a whole land that is sitting there and the city has given to create almost like a camp again for homeless. So this concept of homelessness in Los Angeles and Los Angeles County and even Southern California, let's say, is growing constantly. So the concept of in a first world country, when they say the economy is going very well, and then yet the ratio of the homeless every day is also growing, somehow in my brain don't match, Mariam.
So Fujian, there is so much to say about all of this. I hope we can at least unpack it to the extent that's possible. There's so much to say that I usually forget all that there is to talk about in order to address everything that you brought up, which is all fair and good. You know, part of, so this is, I have a few hats, right? I have my personal opinions as a human being and a citizen, and then I have my roles in the city. I sit on the City Commission on the Status of Women, so I was appointed to that commission by the mayor, and I also chair something called the West Side Regional Alliance of Councils, which covers the entire West Side of Los Angeles, and homelessness is definitely one of the things that we deal with. And to the extent that homelessness dovetails with land use and land use policy, development policy, that's kind of on my plate too. So just starting out with my personal hat, like as a personal citizen of the United States and as a human being who observes what you do, you know, when I drive around my little community or Los Angeles City or the broader county of Los Angeles, I see the same thing that you do. There's a lot of homelessness on the street, and no matter what the economy seems to be doing, there's still homelessness on the street.
And rising.
Right, and rising. And we'll talk about that too, because LA County had its homeless count, and they just released the statistics a couple of months ago in April, and the statistics showed that homelessness was rising. Whereas last year when they did the count, the statistics showed homelessness reducing ever so slightly, but still now we're back on rising. So from my personal point of view, I just want to say the fact that the economy is doing well is something that translates into the lives of people who have jobs, right? You know, I don't even think that it translates necessarily into the lives of people who have hourly jobs. It translates into the lives of people who have careers and salaries, because companies do well, manufacturers do well, and so people's pay goes up. When we're talking about homeless people, we're not talking about the economy anymore. We're talking about our values as a society, right? So do we value human life? Do we believe that a safe, sanitary roof over the head of every individual in, as you say, one of the richest countries on earth is, I don't want to say a right, but is a necessity. And it's a necessity that we can probably provide if we were to shift our priorities, which we don't do. We still look at developers as being people who build communities, and we believe that they should make money. So in order to put the pressure on developers and say to them that they should have more affordable housing units, or, you know, not even housing units, and I don't know the answers. I'm not saying I have the answers. Right. But if we were to talk about land use policy in a way that factored in fundamental fairness and factored in the obvious housing crisis that we have in a bold way, instead of this sidelined apologetic way, maybe we would see more housing. Because ultimately the problem is that we need more housing density, and we need that housing to be affordable for these people. So, you know, when homeless people have an income, most of them get some sort of a state or city or county provided income. They get to take that income and put it towards their rent. When they do that, they can get a voucher, right? The voucher enables them to go and rent a place but not pay full rent. And then there are all these other subsidies that come into play that help them pay rent, but they're still paying rent. So whoever owns that unit is still making money. You know, can we as a society agree that the person who owns that unit can make less money so that these people can be housed? I don't know, but if that's a conversation we can have, then that's a starting point on housing. Another issue is that landlords evict. So you might have a family, and a lot of times, Fujian, these families are headed by single mothers, right? So women who are alone heading families, they work and they raise children, right? If they miss their rent for a month or two, their landlord has the right to evict them. A lot of times they will be evicted. Many times people who are working will experience homelessness because they cannot afford the roof over their head. Many times, in fact, this is one of the subsets of the homeless population that's growing, these people will end up in their cars, right? So, you know, they're homeless now in their cars. City Council, the city of LA basically has an ordinance that limits the places that you can park your car and sleep in it overnight, okay? It's the vehicular dwelling ordinance. So there are precious few places where you can go, maybe with your kids, park your car, and sleep safely overnight without having a cop move you. So again, we're not giving people too many options, and we're not really having the hard conversations about how we as a society probably have to reevaluate our values in order to provide just a baseline for people. And I don't know that I have the answers, but I do know that the conversation probably is going to have to be had one of these days.
So, Maya, there's a couple of things that show up for me as you were talking. One is I'm hearing that the concept of the causality of this is a couple of things I'm hearing from you. People who have no option for working due to whether it's mental illness or physical illness, or there's some sort of disability, let's say, that may not get them to work. Then the second part is that they are able to work, or at least one person in the family, such as the mother or someone, has the ability to work, but their income that they're bringing in is not sufficient enough in order to house them with a high amount that it's going. And the third part I'm hearing is that the way that the system of housing is set up it's very rigid in a way, and the rigidity is obviously to the benefit of the developers and who owns the space. So it doesn't have the flexibility to be able to be given this type of accommodation, let's say, to right. someone who is working hourly or doesn't have the capacity to find jobs or work at jobs that have higher degree. Plus that in Los Angeles, the rate of housing is going so high that not many people under a certain amount of salary can any longer pay for those housing. Are these a couple of things that I'm hearing?
Yes. And I'd like to unpack all of them. Let me just start with the last note, the last item that you mentioned, and that is income, right? Los Angeles has raised the minimum wage, right? So right now in California, in LA city and county, the minimum wage is higher than it is almost anywhere else, right? Even with that higher minimum wage, and when we talk about minimum wage, we're talking about hourly wage, right? Even with that, it's still not a living wage for someone in California or in Los Angeles. If you were to compare that to 30 years ago, someone who was working an hourly job getting paid the minimum wage would be able to pay their rent and put some money aside. That doesn't happen anymore. As we raise that minimum wage, or we call it the living wage, which means it's got to be even higher than what it is now, you're asking employers to pay more. Employers that probably don't want to pay more because they're paying taxes or workman's comp or whatever somewhere else. And those employers, if they're small enough not to be publicly traded companies, we're talking about employers who are filing income tax based on their business. And so they want to maximize their income too, right? Because they live in Los Angeles and so the whole system doesn't really, as you say, leave much wiggle room for a catch-all, right? So there are plenty of people falling through the cracks, and there's no policy catch-all, right? So let me now go back to the beginning. The mayor of Los Angeles is trying to address this, but again, he's swimming against the stream. I want to go back to the beginning of what you were saying, which was all the different ways that people become homeless. There are people who are disabled in some way, and you're right, they can't work. We in this city call them chronically homeless people. They're people who have been homeless for a long enough period of time, as I'm sure you can well understand, that they develop some sort of mental illness. And with that, they develop some sort of chemical dependency. So these people slowly become unable to pound out a normal routine that would enable them to keep a job or hold a job or even pay their rent or take their meds on time. These people require what we call permanent supportive housing. So
yes.
All the measures that we vote for, the H and the HHH and all that stuff, all that major money that we're raising so that we can build permanent supportive housing for these people, right?
Yes. Yeah, because I worked as the head of the outpatient hospitalization and inpatient hospitalization for many years. And this was pretty much a lot of our patients who had mental illness or had addiction, which both they had mental illness and addiction, And it was a revolving door between the outpatients and the inpatients and the streets. And it's heart-wrenching. It's truly heart-wrenching that, as you say...
They are the hardest population to help. They need permanent supportive housing, which means somebody's got to show up and help them do everything. The issue is, Bujan, that if we were to be able to address the root causes of homelessness and stem the flow into homelessness or be able to get people out of homelessness when they first get in, we would have fewer of these chronic homeless people that we then have to invest this money in to give them wraparound services for the rest of their lives.
Yes.
Which brings me to your second point. Your second point was people who are able to work but either can't find jobs, so lack of opportunity, or are working and just can't make a living wage. So in the city of Los Angeles, people got together and they decided that, you know, hourly wage workers don't really have an opportunity to develop a career that gives them a salary that they can build on. So the city decided that they were going to try to focus some of their career workforce over onto these disadvantaged people. They actually focused a little bit more on women who were singularly head household, so that women would get out of what we usually see them in, which is wage jobs, right? They're either in retail or they're the service industry or they're at a hotel or whatever, so that they could have careers. Presumably careers give you salary. Salary gives you the ability to get a raise. That raise gives you the ability to keep the roof over your head. On the other hand, the catch-all thing that we were talking about, again, in this city, the mayor's trying to put together a coalition of attorneys who can work pro bono to give people legal assistance when it comes to evictions, right? So slowly to change the narrative that, you know, as soon as someone misses their rent, you don't necessarily have to evict them. You can look at their circumstances. You can know that there's a battery of support behind them. Allow them to stay. Let them regain themselves. Because if we don't, we pay the price as a society later when they become chronically homeless with, you know, chemical dependence, and they need us to pass another measure so that we can, you know, support permanent supportive housing. So again, it's a mindset. People have to decide that they're going to help people or care for people or actually notice vulnerable people before they become, you know, I hate to say it, but before they become a burden on society. It's a change in the way that we think. I mean, to end homelessness is a change in the way that we think. The other big part of it, and I would love to hear you on this, the other big part of it is that a generation, maybe more, a couple of generations ago, we as a society decided that we were going to close down mental health hospitals, right? For whatever reason, whether they were corrupt or they were, you know, not functioning properly or there was abuse, we decided we were going to close our mental health system. The idea was that, at least in the state of California, the idea was that we would close our mental health systems and then find community-based solutions where we would integrate people and give them the mental health assistance and bring them into society in a way that would help rehabilitate them. That never happened. So what ended up happening was that they were on the street. And on the street, they were either swept up into the criminal system. They were taken to jails. Eventually, jails became overcrowded. We couldn't keep them. So we started calling some of those crimes misdemeanors so they wouldn't carry jail terms. And then if they weren't in jail, they were on the street. If they got sick on the street, they'd be in the hospital or in the emergency room for 2 days, 4 days, whatever the case may be. Then they were back out on the streets. So again, you know, we decided that we were going to shut down our mental health support system, but we didn't put anything in place of it. And now we're wondering where these people have to go. Well, they don't have a place to go. Our streets is where they go.
Yes, that has a lot to do with insurance coverages, where most of the places where the hospitals and the system at the hospital was not supposed to create a residence for them. But so the hospital, due to the insurance coverages, could not sustain under the term of being a hospital to house someone, you know, even longer than a week or so to give them some kind of a maintenance. Then the outpatients that we were also handling, outpatient hospitalization still needs a cognitive ability. So if someone is completely, you know, in a schizophrenic or a hallucinatory concept, or they have been so depleted that the basic They don't even have basics to come to a setup, which they're there for 6 hours and maybe they'll get one or two meals and then they're going to go off the street, and they wouldn't necessarily get a lot of cognitive abilities and cognitive skills from these places. So then, like you said, they were creating community spaces where was the funding coming from? And I think at that time funding was coming from Medi-Cal. To bring them and create social skills versus just cognitive skills, to create social skills and give them some meals and, you know, for them to be there. But they left around 4 p.m. to the same streets. There was still no housing. Right. So I get it that there's like bits and pieces of things that are working only for one aspect, because that's how, you know, the systems work. But like you said, there is no wraparound system, which one, you know, one social worker is attending to someone and they can place them so that the wraparound, they can get the meals, they can get a place to sleep and all of that. Another part that I had heard from many people who were creating shelters and housing was that it was difficult for them due to mental illness, paranoia, some people who wanted to still use on the streets, some of the crime, that it was also when they found the places that it was difficult to keep them in those places. What are your what have you found and seen as with the reports on this concept that even if the housing was created, that it was difficult for homeless, some of the homeless to actually reside and stay there continuously?
So let me just circle back to the hospital issue that you were talking about. You know, the reality is that whenever we hear these reports or read articles about the fact that when hospitals are done with patients who have no place to live, so homeless patients, they dump the, you know, we say they dump them on the street. And it's true, they do. But the reality is they have no place else to take them. There is no other place. And we, at least in California, have decided that we don't want to create homeless communities, right? So we're not going to take like four city blocks and build a bunch of tents and say this is where homeless people go. We have decided that the better way to tackle this would be to integrate homeless people into the communities. And for the most part, every community across Los Angeles has homeless people. The idea is take them in and house them where they are. And that speaks to what you were just talking about. People are more likely to succeed in housing options if it's close to or at the same place where they experience homelessness. Because shockingly, and I say this everywhere I go, homeless people are people too. Shockingly, they make friends, they have routines, they have a comfort zone, they get used to their surroundings, right? So if you tell someone, hey, you're homeless, you can't stay here, let's go, I'm going to ship you, you know, 40 miles away, I'm going to give you a bunk bed in a shelter, you're going to live with a bunch of people you don't know, some of them have mental health issues, they might be screaming through the night, and by the way, you know, the dog that you've loved for the last 10 years, you can't take with you, of course, they will not succeed. They will not want to be housed under those conditions. And yes, we have in the little community that I work in and the organization that I helped create, we have housed many people, but we have also not succeeded in housing many of the people that we thought we had pulled into the system who insisted on getting back out. Some people have a lot of false starts, like you were saying. So they'll get a housing option, they'll move into it, they realize they just can't do it, they can't be sober all day, they can't not use, they've got to get back out on the street. They'll get on a bus, they'll go back to wherever it was that they came from, they'll say hi to their friends, and they'll get back into whatever it was doing, because it's their comfort zone, right? And then they'll get sick on the street again, and then one more time they try it again. Some of them take three or four, you know, tries to succeed. Some of them never succeed. We had one gentleman who lived on the street for many years, had become addicted to alcohol, was in very, very bad shape, was near death when we got him housed. And he was like, you know what? I don't want to live like this. I don't want to live here. I don't want to have to do this. He went back out on the street, and within about 10 days, he died. He died of alcohol poisoning. So we are talking about people who have routines, and to ask them to suspend that routine overnight is unrealistic. You've got to be able to be patient with them. We have to give them options that they think they can live with. You know, yes, I know we see them all as, oh, undeserving people, but they're people. And if we want our processes to succeed, we have to take into account the people we're dealing with.
Yes. I wanted to tell you, I'm sure you know about this research, but our audience and everybody, we're talking to Maryam Zahr. The research says that experiencing homelessness at any time during the pre or postnatal period can negatively affect a young child's health. This was done in Children's Health Watch, based out of Boston Medical Center, found that children who experienced both pre and postnatal homelessness and those who experienced homelessness for longer than 6 months were at highest risk of negative health outcomes. And then the research interviewed 20,000 low-income caregivers of children under 4 years old who visited outpatient pediatric clinics in 5 cities across the United States. So how long they experienced homelessness and when the child's life they experienced homelessness actually was part of the assessment in determining that sometimes this type of health outcome, these type of high risk of poor health outcome are there to stay. Yeah. They're not reversible.
That's a great way for me to bring in female homelessness, which, you know, is something I work on. Again, I sit on the City Commission on the Status of Women, and we decided a couple of years ago on the commission that our focus would be on female homelessness and its nexus with domestic violence, which I'm sure is something you can speak to. For the most part, a vast majority of women who experience homelessness have gotten there after having experienced multiple forms of domestic violence and abuse. Disempowerment is disempowerment in whatever way, shape, or form it gets delivered to a human being. The earlier it gets delivered, the bigger the impact is. And if you're disempowered from an early age, you learn to grow up to endure disempowerment. And homelessness is no different. Experiencing homelessness as a child is a form of disempowerment. Frankly, experiencing homelessness as a woman is a form of disempowerment because women are particularly vulnerable on the street. Yes. They are more likely to fall to prey. And being homeless and being female is a really difficult state of being. And I think it's a pall on our society that we're willing to endure it. But just to come back to the research, I may not have read the research that you quoted, but I have read so much. And there is so much out there on the impact of homelessness on children. One of the reasons I advocate as hard as I do about female homelessness is because if we can control, if we can tackle, you know, if we can really focus on female homelessness as a society and tackle it with purpose, we really are protecting another generation from experiencing homelessness. So a lot of times, like I was saying to you before, if you're talking about a woman who's a single family head of a household and she has kids, if she experiences homelessness with those children, chances are much greater that those children will grow up and experience homelessness. So yes, dealing with family homelessness and female homelessness is an investment in our collective future. That is certainly true. The other part of the statistics that say that children who experience homelessness are more likely to experience it as an adult, you know, it becomes the impossible that they end up having to face and get used to. And by virtue of the fact that as a child, they faced it and they got used to it or they endured it or they watched their parents cycle through it, that makes them more likely to think they can endure it or consider it as an option as they get older. And so it really is a dangerous path when we're willing to be a society that looks at family homelessness and excuses it somehow or dismisses it somehow. You know, it's a huge battle to come up with funding to tackle homelessness. There are all sorts of homeless people, and I can't say that one person is more deserving of funding than another. But when I go to my state lawmakers and I say, hey, look, allocate a certain amount of funding just for female homelessness, I really have to do a lot of work convincing people that it's okay to earmark this particular subset of the homeless population, call it the vulnerable population that it is, and then focus resources on it. Because really, we're talking about focusing resources not just on women, but an entire new generation of people that we're trying to keep from being homeless. So, you know, the more you can talk about this, the happier I'll be, because laws, and I was just on another television show last week talking about this, laws and policies are tough to make.
Yes.
lawmakers have to go to bat for the stuff that they believe in, right? Any chamber they sit in, from your city level to your state to the federal level, they've got to advocate for whatever law, bill, ordinance it is that they're presenting to their colleagues. They advocate only as hard as public opinion pushes them to, right? So if the public says, you know what, no female homelessness, we do not believe that it reflects the values of today's world, that lawmaker, your politicians, will then have the power to go and advocate for whatever it is that you're talking about. So again, you know, people assume that it's just your politicians making laws. It's not true. We all have a voice. And if we can become informed about the circumstances that impact our lives, then we can talk to our lawmakers in an informed way and give them the support they need to go out and solve some of the bigger problems that we can't deny are there. And homelessness is at the point where there's no denying for anyone that there are too many homeless people across this land, and something's got to be done. Yes. People cannot languish on the street.
Absolutely. Before you go, I want you to also talk about Uncommon Conversations, your radio and podcast show. Tell us about it.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me that plug. So Uncommon Conversations is a radio and podcast show that I co-host with a gentleman named John Harlow. John is a British journalist. He used to work for the Sunday Times in London. He moved to California, to Venice, not long ago. And the story is kind of interesting. I wouldn't mind telling it to you one day. But the short version is that soon after the media blackout that happened in Syria, a lot of these newspapers sort of had to shrink their international correspondence platform. And so people like John ended up with an opportunity to move and, you know, make a change. So he moved here. I was lucky enough to meet him. So we've gotten together and we've created Uncommon Conversations, which is a weekly show that tries to talk about kind of what we were just talking about. Things that are issues that are local, hyper-local, as well as issues that are global. And we try to talk about the way that current events impact the policies that impact your life. So try to get people to talk about, you know, maybe like protests in Hong Kong. Yes, they're far removed and they don't impact you, but to the extent that they do, let's talk about how the world is interconnected. So we have these conversations with either journalists or specialists or researchers about the issues that impact people's lives. And we try to make it a little bit more entertaining so that everybody realizes that entertainment doesn't just come from sitcoms and fiction. You know, it can be very engaging to talk about the real stuff that happens in the world.
Absolutely. Yes, they do. Tell us also about Women Found. This is a nonprofit organization. You founded it, which also advocates for women and especially advocates for women in societies and countries which are set up as a patriarchal system, which women don't have so much of a say-so.
Yeah. Women Found, I founded Women Found shortly after we went into Iraq in 2001, I want to say, or 2002. And the reason was that, like you say, it was to help raise awareness and to, with that awareness, help empower women across the Middle East, North Africa, and the Afghanistan, Pakistan region. And the reason was that when we So I'm Persian, right? But by the grace of God, do I have the life that I have, right? I could live somewhere else in the Middle East and, you know, not have the autonomy or the freedom of movement that I have now. And at some point when I became an adult, that became a reality for me that, you know, I hadn't really done anything particularly special to get the life that I'd gotten. It was just by chance. And if I had the opportunity to have a voice, then I owed it to everybody else to use that voice to empower those people that didn't have one. So as these ideas were swirling around my head, we went into Iraq, and I'm a news junkie, as you know. And as I would dig deep into reports that were coming out of Iraq, I realized that one of the first things that happened to Iraqi society once the war set in and conflict really took over people's lives was that the rights of women and girls were pulled back the quickest and the hardest. The women who could work before couldn't work anymore. Girls who used to be able to go to school and dream to be whatever they wanted to couldn't do that anymore. Honor killings were on the rise. all sorts of things that impacted women and girls in a negative way seemed to be on the rise. And I thought, you know what? That entire region is constantly mired in conflict that's often exported over to them. And so it became my quest to try to bring awareness to the West so that everybody in the West would at least realize that, hey, this is what's going on. I know you care. Let's try to help. So we started to raise money and awareness to help empower women and girls across the world. And honestly, empowerment comes in all increments, as you know. I mean, you can get warm clothes to a girl, and that can be empowering because now they don't need something from someone else that they have to go and get by whatever way they can. And it can come in big ways, like building a school and helping them be literate. Because as you know, mothers who are literate end up raising more empowered children. So, you know, efforts large and small, we take them on to the extent that we can. And the idea is to make the whole world kind of know how everybody else lives.
Yes. And with that,
that helps us help each other, then it's a good thing.
Yes, as long as we have the knowledge, because when we're not informed, we come up with ideas in our head that are not accurate, and then we make decisions based on not accurate information. And I think the ability to see the world as is from a different angle, it really allows us to do that. Where can people find you?
Ooh, so people can find us. People can find me from my profile on the LA City website for the Commission on the Status of Women. Mm-hmm. My bio is there and plenty of links. People can find us on womenfound.org. The site is down right now for remodeling, I guess it's called, revamping, but a couple of months. Uncommon Conversations on Facebook, Women Found on Facebook, Women Found on Twitter. And then that's it. I mean,
iTunes, right? Uncommon yes. Conversations. People can find you on iTunes and Stitcher and all of the podcast places they could ever find, right?
Yes. And iHeartRadio. Yeah.
iHeartRadio.
And also always reach out to you because you're one of my favorite people and I will always answer the phone call.
Thank you. You are the sweetest. Thank you so much for taking the time and being with me. And I know you got to run to your wonderful mother, to your children. You got to take your son from school. So thank you so much for being with us. And for everyone out there, remember, just get to know your surrounding, get to know people. We are the people who we are probably this far, any of us, from homelessness. I've worked with so many homeless that if I could tell you who they were in their 20s and 30s and 40s, you'll be shocked that they are at this time of their life homeless. So it's not beyond any of us. So it's caring for people, knowing who they are, and even if they are choosing at one point to be somewhere else, but they choose to be on the street, to know that they're people and love them and talk to them. They'd love to hear from you and at least get everybody to get a human to human contact. So create a wonderful world that around you and give your love like there's no tomorrow to everyone who you come in contact with. Bye-bye.